When Robert LeLoux was growing up in Petunia, Texas, living on his grandparents' cattle ranch, he always looked forward to Saturdays. That's when he and his mother would drive a couple of hours into Houston to get their hair and nails done together at Neiman Marcus. And then one day, they came home to a note from Robert's father.
In the Dear John letter Daddy left for Mother and me, on a Saturday afternoon in early June 1996, Daddy wrote that he was leaving us because Mother was crazy, and because she'd driven me crazy in a way that perfectly suited her own insanity.
Robert LeLoux's new book is called The Memoirs of a Beautiful Boy, and as you might have guessed, that was Robert LeLoux. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
This book is a great big Texas sparkler.
Oh.
It's full of Texas witticism, stories of growing up gay, larger-than-life characters, and a mom who simply defies belief. And on that note, I would just like to ask, in light of recent publishing events, is it all true?
Yes, it is. I always joke and say that the boring parts are made up. You know, anything that seems completely unbelievable is gospel truth, but I had to sort of find a way to get everybody in the room at the same time. So,
you and your mom were almost twinned at the hip. You're
yes.
an only child. You and your mom finished each other's sentences. She was your only friend for a long, long time, and you were her only friend. When did that start?
Oh, I think, you know, I always say that, you know, that Pirandello play, six characters in search of an author. My mother was in search of an author, and then she got pregnant. So I think from the womb on.
So tell us about her. She was an obvious glamour puss.
Yes, was and is. I think a star in search of a stage and a woman who's never been entirely aware that the cameras aren't rolling. And I think sort of a pre-women's movement throwback to all of those women we grew up with, the geniuses of the cocktail party.
That's right, because in many ways she read to me like a 50s woman, but you're writing about the 1990s in Texas.
Yeah, I don't think the women's movement really came to Texas until the 90s. I think it sort of officially arrived with Ann Richards, who herself had for many years been one of those genius housewives, you know, so.
Mm-hmm. You open this book with the biggest drama of your adolescence, and that's your daddy leaving the two of you for another woman.
Yes.
And this launches your mother, this glamour seeker, into an unbelievable strategy of finding a new husband and enlisting you in the effort. Would you tell us about when she suffers from a hair condition, which actually
yes.
makes her real hair too patchy, and so
yes.
so she decides to get plastic hair.
Yes, well, she had lost all of her hair years before through bleaching it, and it had all fallen out, and for years she'd worn wigs, which was great because big Texas over-the-top blonde hair, that worked. But then she fell in love with a man from California. And the big Texas blonde hair didn't quite play. And so she saw a commercial advertising some treatment that would give you real hair. And it turns out that the solution to this problem that these people have developed is to shave my mother's head bald and to glue fake hair on that it looks like a Muppet. It looks like a little yellow pom-pom just sort of appliqued onto the top of her.
You know, but I have to say your concern for her as you're watching this process was so tender.
Oh, well, I adore my mother.
Well, why don't we bring her in? We have a surprise. Yay. Jessica Wilson, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
It's like this
so
is
nice
your life.
To be, yes.
This is wonderful.
It's so nice to be here.
It's great to have you. I would like to have the two of you read from Robert's book in which he tells you that maybe he's not quite like other guys.
Okay. Depends on which guys you're talking about. Okay. So I am 17 years old. My mother is going through her horrible divorce, and I have fallen in love with the man who is my partner today, the love of my life, Michael LeLoux. I thus realize I am gay, and I tell my mother about it in the following scene. Mother, I waited several weeks to say, I have an announcement to make.
I'm listening.
Mother, I have fallen in love with Michael LeLoux, which also means I'm gay.
How could you be my child and not be gay? Women like me always have gay children. Cher, Lana Turner, Queen Elizabeth. My God, look at Queen Elizabeth.
Mother, I groaned, how did you become the subject of this conversation?
Because, Robert, I will always be the only woman in your life. Because, Robert, I adore you.
So, Jessica Wilson, I just have to ask you, you are a delightful but absolutely outrageous character here.
You know, the scary thing about that is I thought everything I did made perfect sense. And honestly, I thought, I don't have any hair. I'll just shave it all off and glue some on. That made perfect sense to me at that time, which is really scary. Yeah.
You know, the real Texas part of this started for me, Robert, when you met Michael Leloup and his family. And this Catholic Cajun family took him in, Jessica, when you had left to go to California to marry your boyfriend.
Correct.
Were you worried about that?
No. I was thrilled that they moved in because it sort of provided an anchor and a normalcy that they both needed and a protection because they were gay in Texas, and that's not really a good thing to be, really. Even now, it's better now, but back then it was just really dangerous.
My mother moved to California and since then has begun to discuss her home state as though it is Iran.
You are a native Texan, Jessica?
Yes, unfortunately.
Well, I think quite fortunately. I love Texas. I don't happen to live there, but so many marvelous
That's why
people.
You love it, because you're not there.
Well, but I think the best place in the world for a writer to come from.
Okay,
I think it's
I
one of the last
that.
Places in America, along with Brooklyn and the Bronx and a handful of other places that only sound like itself. I think it's wonderful. So.
I want to ask both of you, now that life is going a little bit better, I hope it is. It seems
yes.
like it is. You're both living in New York.
Yes.
Think you'll be as funny?
Well, I think that this is the station where the hits don't ever stop. I think, you know, it's wonderful. I think we've both inherited gallows humor, you know, as a coping mechanism. And I think that is just, if I had some sort of magic wand to wave over a crib, I would give someone the gift of being able to laugh at the worst parts of your life. I don't think there's anything more valuable than that.
Robert Leloup's new book is The Memoirs of a Beautiful Boy. His mother, Jessica Wilson, is a prominent figure in the book, and she joined us, and we want to thank both of you.
Thank you so much.
You can read an excerpt about the day the author's mother mysteriously disappeared at the podiatrist's office at npr.org/books. And now, one of those NPR goodbyes. For almost 5 years, All Things Considered has had a secret weapon on the weekends, a spark plug named Martha Wexler, who is our senior editor and our whipsnapper, our Russia scholar, and just a fount of knowledge. I've often thought that the ultimate NPR auction item might be an unedited NPR script, something like Trimalchio in West Egg, which she has changed to The Great Gatsby. Well, move over, Maxwell Perkins. Martha has her own voice. She used that voice in myriad ways, to fight for our show's content, to reject what's boring, wrong, prejudiced, banal. She took pride in finding that gifted detail that makes all the difference. If a story on this show has ever moved you, the chances are very, very good that it was her imagination you were engaging. What we cannot say here is how much her incisive intelligence and unbounded curiosity will be missed, not to mention her indefatigable energy. Thank you, Martha. You leave us to develop your voice, but believe me, in our heads, we won't be forgetting the words you left behind. That's All Things Considered from NPR News. Andrea Seabrook is back next week. I'm Jackie Lydon. This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Lydon. Serbia's prime minister dissolved his government today and called for new elections. Vojislav Koštunica, a nationalist, said his government was too fractured to function. He accused his pro-Western coalition partners of failing to defend Serbia's claim to Kosovo. Kosovo's declaration of independence last month sparked fierce protests from Serbs who consider that land the cradle of their civilization. Angry mobs in Belgrade attacked the U.S. embassy as they held America responsible for the humiliating final fracturing of what was once Yugoslavia. A new book takes us back to the Balkan Wars of the 90s, when Yugoslavia was breaking apart and descending into bloodshed. It's a biography of a terrifying figure known to the world as Arkan. His real name was Jelko Raznatovic. He was a master criminal who went on to recruit legions of football hooligans and formed a bloodthirsty paramilitary. The new biography of Arkan is called Hunting the Tiger: The Fast Life and Violent Death of the Balkans' Most Dangerous Man. Author Christopher Stewart took me through Arkan's notorious career.
Arkan started off as a petty thief, and he left for Europe in his early 20s, became one of Europe's most prolific bank robbers. But the way he did it was sort of unique. He had this sort of quid pro quo with the Yugoslav secret security agency. They said, we'll give you fake passports, we'll give you aliases, we'll give you all the resources you need to be a professional criminal if you work as a hitman for us and kill off political dissidents. And of course, he took the deal, and it made him an enormously successful bank robber. And when he did get put in jail, he managed to escape. And for that, he killed off numerous political dissidents for Tito's government.
He gets a contract from the Yugoslav state security apparatus for a contract hit on a dissident. And your description of that is incredible. He spends night after night on a rooftop waiting for the target to show up.
Right. This is in Germany. The target is a Kosovo dissident. He is really one of the philosophical thinkers behind the first Kosovo-Albanian dissidents. And Tito wanted this guy dead so he could stomp out any sort of ethnic divisions. So Arkan sets himself up on the roof of this guy's apartment. And finally, after a week or so, this guy arrives. But he doesn't arrive alone. He arrives with a whole crew of people. And, of course, Arkan doesn't know what to do about this. He actually calls the state security and says to them, I think I'll just kill them all. And like I said, no, that's just a mess. There's no way. You can't do that. You have to wait. So Arkan waits and waits, and finally the target emerges from the building and he shoots him down. And then, like all the other hits, he vanishes.
At the beginning of the war, after Tito is gone and Milosevic has come to power in Serbia, Arkan is actually hired to insert his paramilitary group of thugs, which he called the Tigers, and is basically paid to go in and ethnically cleanse in places like Vukovar in Croatia and Behalina in just inside Bosnian territory. And he really gets the ball rolling.
That's right. The Tigers became a complement to the Yugoslav army. They were the ones that were sent in initially to cleanse a town, torture people, mutilate, and clear everyone out.
Well, you said they actually cut off noses and ears.
They created torture chambers, separated women and children from the men, you know, drove the men off into the woods and systematically killed them. And there are some horrific stories, first in Croatia and then in Bosnia.
Let me ask you, Christopher Stewart, Arkan was never brought to trial, even though he was indicted by the UN War Crimes Tribunal in The Hague, because he was assassinated early in 2000, before he could be. But by the time it was all over, he had become such a target. You compare him a little bit to Osama bin Laden. He was so high profile. Did he, do you think, create the Serbian vengeance that you portray here, or was he a product of it?
He did embody this Serbian vengeance. You know, you go over to Belgrade and you talk to people these days, and Arkan is still sort of this icon.
What does that say to you about Serbians? Well, I know that he's not revered by everyone, but what does it say to you about the Serbian consciousness?
He is not. The specter of Arkan is still very much alive in Serbia. I'd say that many of the young people, they want to become more Western, they want the European Union, but there is this sort of yearning for a stronger Serbia. A time when, you know, Milosevic was in power, you know, Serbia was strong in the region, and in that way, that's how Arkan is still very much a part of the psyche of Serbia.
Christopher Stewart's new book is called Hunting the Tiger: The Fast Life and Death of the Balkans' Most Dangerous Man. Christopher Stewart, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
And you can read an excerpt about the harrowing day Stewart ran into Arkan's forces at npr.org/books.
Robin Wright first went to the Middle East when it was torn by war in the mid-1970s. 30 years later, you might be tempted to say, so what's new? But in her new book, Dreams and Shadows, the well-traveled foreign policy correspondent for The Washington Post and frequent visiting fellow at top universities and think tanks, sees a whole cast of people who are subtly and effectively working for change in a host of places where it may not be immediately visible. Robin Wright, special friend of this program, always available to us, joined us in our studios. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's always great to be with you.
I'm afraid we have to start with the news this week, which is discouraging to tragic, and that's, of course, the attack in the Jerusalem seminary that left 8 people dead. Israel says peace talks will continue. This sort of thing seems to happen on the crest of any peace talks. What effect does it have?
Events on the ground often overtake diplomacy, and it's the biggest problem the United States has had under any administration in getting both sides to actually move forward. The reality is that extremism is going to be a factor in the region for a long time to come. It has been visible for now more than 2 decades, and it'll be with us for at least another generation. We have a lot to burn out. I think one of the reasons I went to write this book was to look at the other side of the story, and that is what's happening beyond the things we become so obsessed about, mm-hmm. whether it's the Arab-Israeli crisis, Iraq, the emergence of Al-Qaeda in an ever-growing number of countries.
These are movements sometimes and often people and individuals who are trying to accomplish things kind of irrespective of the agenda of other powers.
What's really striking is the way that they're trying to create or carve out new political space beyond the limitations imposed by the regimes in the region, which are all virtually autocrats. And what's inspiring in some ways is the way people are at great personal risk trying to hold governments to account, to force public debate on issues, to force governments, because of growing body of evidence they provide, to take action against those who are engaged in human rights abuses.
Let me get you to talk about some of them. Impressive person in Syria, Riyad al-Turk, spent 18 years in solitary confinement.
Yes, and what's so striking about Riyad al-Turk, who is the Nelson Mandela of Syria, is that he was held in a room the size of an elevator shaft. No windows, no furniture, no toilet, no contact with anyone else. And he kept himself sane by taking the small, uncooked kernels of rice from his soup at night and every day on the ground building geometric designs. And what did he do at the age of 68 when he emerged? He started criticizing the government again, and he went back to jail. These are the kinds of people we actually don't hear a lot about, and there are a lot of them out in the region.
I was also impressed by an account of a man who, alas, has subsequently died, Driz Ben Zekri. This is also a man who was the victim of torture.
Oh, he was held a long time in Morocco. He was a young leftist picked up when he was in his 20s, brutally tortured by the regime. And he came out. And one of the interesting things, one of the more hopeful places in some ways, is Morocco, where the king organized a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, much like the one we saw in South Africa, to deal with the abuses of his father and his grandfather over a 4-decade period. And Driz Ben Zekri, who had suffered from this, was made head of the commission. And he went back and helped account for the hundreds, maybe even thousands of people who had simply disappeared into police custody and died there. Helped work out a formula of compensation for many of the victims' families.
I want to follow up on something that I guess King Mohammed VI told you, which I found interesting. He conceded the point that Morocco had not become Sweden under his rule. But he did say, I think this bluntly, we are not Spain or Sweden. We need a kind of democracy that fits us, not some kind of Western model.
Absolutely. And that's the refrain from all of the leaders in the region. What we're dealing with are governments that do not want to share power. Look at the case of Hosni Mubarak, who has now ruled in Egypt longer than anyone over a 6,000-year period, except for 2 pharaohs. These are regimes that are going to engage in...
And he wants his son to succeed him, too. Seems to be preparing the way.
Absolutely. Gamal Mubarak is being groomed as his heir apparent. All of these regimes want to engage in tokenism. They want to talk the democratic game, which is in itself interesting, but without doing very much, conniving, in fact, to do all they can to avoid it.
Let me get you to talk about Hamas, the enterprise and the people. I was struck by a man, I guess, Osama Hamdan of Hamas, talking about U.S. policy. He compared the U.S. to a prince that's holding out the glass slipper looking for its Cinderella.
That's right. This is the conundrum for the United States and for our allies as we look at the future of the region. In the Palestinian elections in 2006, we saw the freest poll ever conducted in the Arab world. I was there. It was quite extraordinary. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, people voted for a group that the outside world's not very happy with. It is refuses to recognize Israel, has engaged in violence, including in this week, and has not ruled democratically, even in the Gaza Strip. This is the conundrum we all face. What happens if societies do open up and turn to groups that are not particularly friendly with us?
I don't want to leave discussion of your book without talking about something I believe King Abdullah of Jordan mentioned to you, that he said the essential face-off in the Middle East is not between Israelis and Arabs, but Sunni and Shia.
To a certain degree, but I think one of the things that we're seeing on an even broader level is that the clash of civilizations we often talk about is not necessarily between the Islamic world and the West. It's really the clash of civilizations is really within the Islamic world itself. And it plays out not only between Shia and Sunni, but it also plays out among the different ethnic groups. And we can't forget that there are also other religious minorities in the region. Egypt is 10% Coptic Christian. Mm-hmm. At least a fifth of the Palestinians are Christian. There's a lot of diversity in the region. We tend to stereotype it as all Muslims, all angry, all anti-American, and all violent. And that's not the truth. The reality is that the extremists are a tiny minority, and they have not provided the kind of answers to everyday life, whether it's on health care or education or job opportunity. And what's so striking, particularly 7 years after 9/11, is that there is a generation of people that have begun to try to address some of those issues.
Robin Wright, her new book is Dreams and Shadows, The Future of the Middle East. Thanks so much.
Great to be with you.
Poet Lee Young Lee has a new collection, his first in 7 years. Mr. Lee is the acclaimed author of 4 books of poetry and a memoir, The Winged Seed, which won an American Book Award. His new book of poems is called Behind My Eyes, and in it he reflects on his extraordinary family history in meditations and suffering, prayer, death, and love. From New York, Tom Vitale has the story.
Lee Young Lee writes poems that suggest historical events without ever coming out and giving you the whole story. One of the 22 poems in Behind My Eyes is called Self-Help for Fellow Refugees.
If you happen to have watched armed men beat and drag your father out the front door of your house and into the back of an idling truck before your mother jerked you from the threshold and buried your face in her skirt folds, try not to judge your mother too harshly. Don't ask her what she thought she was doing, turning a child's eyes away from history and toward that place all human aching starts.
Lee Young Lee was born into history and suffering to Chinese parents in Indonesia in 1957. Lee says in China, his father, Lee Kuo Yuan, had been Mao Zedong's personal physician.
He worked with Mao. They had a falling out, and because of that, his life was in danger. He fled to Indonesia, and because of his being Chinese and his political and spiritual influences, he was thrown into jail and tortured, and he spent 19 months in a leper colony, and he nearly died, and he escaped. And when I was born, there was a lot of Sinophobia in Indonesia, and they killed like 500,000 Chinese.
When he was 2 years old, Lee Young Lee's family fled from Indonesia in a boat. As political fugitives, they wandered for 7 years from country to country, Singapore, Japan, Malaysia, Hong Kong, and finally to the United States. In 1964, they settled in a small town in western Pennsylvania. But the suffering didn't stop there.
And at that time, I think this country was a little backwards and couldn't tell the difference between Vietnamese and Chinese And so there was a lot of violence directed toward us because this country was at war with an Asian country. And so the whole feeling of the me being threatened, being undermined, you know, even mortally threatened, informs a lot of these poems, I think.
Another poem in Lee Young Lee's new book is called A Hymn to Childhood.
Childhood? Which childhood? The one that didn't last? The one in which you learned to be afraid of the boarded-up well in the backyard and the ladder to the attic, the one presided over by armed men in ill-fitting uniforms strolling the streets and alleys while loudspeakers declared a new era.
You're aware that this is the son or grandson of someone who's had a tremendous connection with culture. And it's rare that you find that in American poetry.
Poet Robert Bly, speaking from his home in Minnesota, says we're lucky to have the work of Lee Young Lee, who has transformed his extraordinary experiences into what Bly calls the wonderful sweet breath of his poetry.
In Lee Young, you see a family that's lived with the very deep Chinese culture for years and years, and he has absorbed that into his body so that he almost never says anything that's trivial or light. And yet, being very thoughtful, he doesn't make you feel a lot of grief for him, whether you have a sense of the grief of life itself.
Which childhood? The one that never ends? Oh, you, still a child and slow to grow, still talking to God and thinking the snow falling is the sound of God listening?
Today, Lee Young Lee lives on the north side of Chicago, in a building he owns with his mother, his sister, and two brothers. He's 50 years old now, with a wife and two grown sons of his own. But he says he feels committed in his poetry to make sense out of his family's suffering in another time and place.
It's not a happy role. I don't embrace it entirely because it's a tough struggle for me, though, because part of me wants to become individuated, and part of me, I mean, in the unconscious life of my family, has been kind of selected to try to put these things into language and to memorialize them and to give the family some sort of context in which to understand the things that happened to us.
Lee Young Lee says he hopes his poetry offers more than the details of his personal experience, that it describes universal suffering and salvation. After arriving in the United States, Lee's father became a Presbyterian minister and remained one until he died in the 1980s. Lee was baptized and studied the scriptures. Now he doesn't go to church anymore, but he sees his poetry as a form of prayer.
For me, I'm trying to get to a condition in the poems, you know, and even in my life of love and compassion and even divine love, you know, that somehow we can look at all of creation and human endeavor, and even in spite of all the atrocities and all the stuff we perpetrate on each other, that somehow we can come to the conclusion that being alive is good and speaking in poems is good and that it's valuable.
Lee Young Lee says as a poet, his real medium is silence, the space between the words, where he hopes he can create a sense of mystery and awe of a spiritual experience.
Why are you crying? My father asked. In my dream, in which we faced each other, knees touching, seated in a moving train, he had recently died, and I was wondering if my life would ever begin. Looking out the window, one of us witnessed what kept vanishing, while the other watched what continually emerged.
For NPR News, I'm Tom Vitale in New York.
And you can hear Lee Young Lee read several of his poems at npr.org/books. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Coming up, how a tragedy led to therapy and then a first album. But first, Sadie Jones' novel, The Outcast, opens with a young man, Louis Aldridge, getting out of prison in Britain in 1957. He goes to buy a gray suit and two white shirts, lights a cigarette, and decides whether to catch a commuter train back to the small suburban home he'd lived in before his arrest. Sadie Jones joins us from London, and let's ask her to read what's going on in her character's mind.
He had never bought clothes for himself before. It was odd that he could have done the things he'd done and not know how to clothe himself. His father had sent him enough money not to come home, but he hadn't asked him not to. Thinking about what he'd done and what his father thought of him wasn't helping, so he'd watched the people on the streets instead. The colours were still very bright. There was a lot of blue sky, and the trees on the pavement seemed marvellous, and the women looked wonderful, and he had to stop himself from staring at all of them. Trying not to stare at women, but still looking at them as much as he could, was a game, and a good way to stop his head from getting away from him, and made him feel alive again. He wondered if you could get arrested for staring at women for an hour outside Victoria Station, and imagined the judge putting him away again the day he got out for picturing them under their clothes. and after a while he was able to cross the street and go into the station and buy his ticket.
Sadie Jones, author of The Outcast, joins us from London. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thank you.
Tell us a bit about Louis Aldridge, your character, because the what he'd done, as you put it in this passage, is to burn down a church.
Yeah.
Is it hard to make a character like that sympathetic?
I find him entirely sympathetic, and I'm always surprised when people say to me, oh, you know, he's a dark character or a difficult character to like, because I was entirely on his side and everything that he does seems to me to make sense.
What makes him go back to this suburban town, Waterford, where everybody knew him and knew the story?
Well, he's a child still, really. Even he's 19, but he has had a sort of arrested development. And he's very much tied in to trying to please his father and trying to... He's not a natural rebel. He doesn't want to be against the society that he's in. And he wants to please and he wants to conform. And that's something... It would be unimaginable for him to go anywhere else.
Could you describe Louis Aldridge to us?
Visually?
Yeah.
When it came to his getting his call-up notice for his national service, yeah, I had to sort of consciously think, what might he be like? Because I don't have a sort of outside image of him at all. I knew he had to be moderately attractive because all these women are attracted to him.
Yes, we should explain. He has a fatal, if inexplicable, charm.
Yeah, he seems to. So I had to make myself decide what colour hair he had or what colour eyes he had because I've never seen him from the outside.
Did it help to set this story in the 50s in a time when, and I'm not comfortable with this truism, by the way, but a time when we think a lot was concealed below the surface?
I was using the 50s to describe the story, well, rather than the story to describe the 50s. From what I know about America, it was more of a boom time then than it was in England, where we had rationing. The villages around London, which are traditionally always been the sort of commuter belt, stolidly middle class and everything done properly, and they're still that way and affluent as well.
You're a screenwriter by trade, I understand.
Yeah.
What do you learn about novel writing from screenwriting?
Well, it was interesting because when I started to write prose, you think that you'll be able to indulge all your imaginative processes and descriptive urges, and then you realize that it's the same thing as with screenwriting, which is, you know, what you take out and what you leave in. It's a sort of constant editing process of trying to make the narrative move and trying to make it visual. That's something that's always important to me, is to write what I see.
You're still working at screenplays?
Yes, I am. I'm hoping to have the career I was trying to have. But I do, you know, I love, I'm writing another novel. And I think now I've tasted that, I don't think that I would stop doing that. But it's very distracting when you have a story living in your head. You've got a sort of, it's like having a film playing all the time. It can be quite distracting. Sort of, to some degree or another, it's always playing.
Speaking with us from London, Sadie Jones. Her new novel, her first, is The Outcast. Miss Jones, so nice to talk to you.
Very nice to talk to you, Scott.
This is Day to Day. I'm Madeline Brand.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Richard Marinick has been a Massachusetts state trooper, a mob enforcer, and an armed robber, for which he went to prison for 10 years. After he got out, Marinick published Boyos in 2004, a highly acclaimed novel that drew on his life as a wise guy in the South Boston criminal underworld. Now Marinick has written a second novel, In for a Pound. It tells the story of Delray McCauley, a former state trooper who went to prison and then struggles to get his life back together when he gets out. Last week, I walked with Marinick through South Boston, which provides the setting for his novel.
This neighborhood has changed a lot, Anthony. It's not the neighborhood that I knew. It's not the neighborhood 20 years ago or for 50 years ago, whatever it was. South Boston was the last bastion of the Irish mob in America, and it was thriving here up until about 15 years ago. I wanted to weave something from my experience there into this book, In for a Pound. So a state trooper coming back to his roots in South Boston after serving a prison term, I knew about that, okay? And that's where the idea came from primarily.
The Irish mob no longer owns these streets, but there are plenty of landmarks from the old days. Marinick points out where Triple O's used to be, the restaurant that was headquarters for the notorious mob boss James Whitey Bulger.
He had an office right above the place. He had what you might call a torture chamber down in the basement. He used to bring people down there, kill them, take them out the back door. There's at least a couple people they took out of there.
Marinick's novel, like much of his life, is set in a world where the lines between the cops and the cons, the legal and the illegal, are often blurry. His fictional mob boss, Jack Wacko Curran, is modeled on the real James Whitey Bulger, who was not only a ruthless gangster, but also an FBI informant. Today he's on the run, wanted for murder, racketeering, and extortion. Bulger is also known for this. His brother is the former state Senate president, William Bulger, for years a major force in state politics.
He was a loved politico over here. People loved him, came out in droves to vote for him. If Jimmy was his brother, Whitey was his brother, how could Whitey be really that bad? And if he was bad, well, he was probably more like a Robin Hood type character. That was the legend that followed Jimmy Bulger around in South Boston. But since he went on the run, a lot of information has come out. He was a drug dealer. He was a murderer. But you get the hardcore cadre that still supports both brothers, saying, no, it couldn't have been that way.
You know, I did some interviews on the street here when he disappeared, and I found some elderly people who didn't strike me as gangsters, but they said things like, when he was around, this neighborhood was safe.
Fact.
I mean, there was sort of this idea that he looked out for his own and he made this place safe.
I agree with that. I mean, in those days, the neighborhood was safe. You had the Irish mob element. You had the gangsters roaming around here. But you didn't have junkies breaking into houses. You did not have people getting mugged in the street, period. It didn't happen. If Mrs. O'Malley has got a group of kids, teenagers, loud and boisterous on her corner, keeping her up at night, everybody in Southie knew someone in those days. She'd make a phone call. It would eventually get back to Jimmy Bulger or one of his lieutenants, and they'd send someone like myself down there. My friends would go down to the corner. You get one warning.
So you had your own crew here.
Yeah.
You had interaction with Jimmy Bulger,
right,
with Whitey Bulger. What was he like? I mean,
Jimmy Bulger was steely-eyed businessman, number one, and a cold-blooded murderer, number two.
And that came across when you looked at him?
There was no doubt. He had these eyes that told you. He had this persona. People will hit you with the aura. This guy pounded you with his aura. You had no doubt when you were dealing with Jimmy Bulger that he would, in fact, kill you if you crossed him. And it happened to me once. I can't go into what I wanted to do. And he told me straight up I'd end up in the trunk of his car.
Now, this theme of this thin line that sort of separates the legal from the illegal, from people who go straight. You were a state cop.
Right.
What happened? Why did you cross that line?
I wasn't patient. I wanted things that I couldn't afford. I was putting a lot of hours in. I wasn't making any money. I looked at my friends over here in Southie, what they had. These are the gangsters. And finally, I said, I had enough. I fell back in with my friends over here, and things just progressed from there.
You know, there was the movie Goodfellas by Scorsese. I thought painted this great image of what attracts young people into leading this kind of wise guy life. And who could resist that? I mean, was that true to life?
A lot of it, absolutely. When I worked in the combat zone years ago as a 19-year-old kid, it was completely dominated by the mafia, the Boston Mafia, La Cosa Nostra in those days. And I'd see the wise guys coming in, and they'd have the beautiful Armani suits on, they'd have the Piaget watches, the beautiful women on their arms, and I saw the respect that these people got from everybody. And I said, geez, maybe I can do that. But I became a cop eventually. I got away from that, and that didn't work out. I said, well, maybe I can try the other side. And I became very proficient at it for a number of years.
So for a number of years, you ran an armed robbery gang. And then what, in 1986, you tried to do what you hope would be your last hit?
You'd like to say this is the last one, one more big one, you know. And we had whacked an armored car out in Williamstown, in the western part of the state. And we got caught. We got caught in a roadblock. And it wasn't my day. And I was caught, and I was sentenced to 18 to 20, along with my Confederates. I ended up doing the 18 to 20, and I got out in about 10 and a half years.
So what went on in prison? Is that, first of all, is that where the writing bug infected you?
No, I've been a writer. I think I was born to write. I was writing even when I was a gangster, when I was running the streets over here. In between scores, I'd be writing. When I was in prison, I decided through the Boston University Prison Education Program, I get fully involved in that. I had a lot of encouragement from my various professors who believed in me, and which made me believe in me.
Let's say that last armored truck heist had gone the way you had planned.
Right.
Where do you think you'd be now?
I'd probably either be dead or in the feds right now. There was an armored car depository out there. That was the next thing we were thinking about hitting. While we were in prison, I was in about a year and a half, and another segment of my crew hit it. They got almost $4 million. And they got caught 3 years later, and they're doing 35 to 40-year prison federal sentences right now. So that's what it was, you know. It wasn't meant to be, you know. My time was up.
You know, these two books, Boyo's and In for a Pound, I gather they're based on stuff that, you know, really happened, that you
sure.
witnessed. Some people are going to look at this kind of literature and say, hey, you know, you're profiting from crimes and from stuff that hurt people. And what do you say to that criticism?
What does Raymond Chandler, Elmore Leonard, Dennis Lehane, Robert Parker do? I mean, it's the same thing. I'm a convicted felon. I'm an ex-con, you know. I've changed my life. I've paid my debt to society. I spent my time in prison. I give back. I work in a county jail. I'm a reentry instructor. I run groups in the prison, in the jail with guys transitioning back into society, run groups in life skills, creative writing, advanced creative writing, poetry, substance abuse, anger management. I'm in there helping. I'm making nickels doing this. You don't get paid well, but it's something that I want to do.
Tell me about that. I mean, it seems like you have something particular to offer these guys.
I have validity, I mean, to offer. I have experience. I've been where they're at. What I do and what I say carries a little bit more weight, let's put it that way.
What do you tell them?
I tell them that there's a lot of negativity in jail, a lot of negativity in state prison. You get people telling them all the time, you're going to get out, you're not going to be able to make it, you're going to have to go back to the old life. No one's going to want you. And I tell them that you can get a job, you can work, you can change your life, you can move forward in a positive way, you can do good things, you know? And there's people out there willing to help you if you're willing to help yourself.
Are you able also to tell them that there are going to be sort of influences out there that are going to try to pull you back in? And I'm just wondering if you felt that since you've been out.
Absolutely. I was heavily recruited. When I came out of prison, good help is hard to find. It's like in any profession. And I was considered good help. And the temptations there, you know, it's nice to be asked, Anthony. It's nice to be asked. But you know what? I'd always say no because I could see where it was going to take me.
Well, Richard, thanks so much. What a pleasure.
Anthony, thank you, sir.
Appreciate it.
Okay.
That's Richard Marinick. His new novel is called In for a Pound. And you can find an excerpt from the book on our website, npr.org.